May it please the court and counsel, Eldon Silverman, 3554, on behalf of Starr, and my colleague must be lost, but luckily he's not arguing. His name is Jersey Green, and he may join me at the table. We are appealing from an adverse decision by the Honorable Judge Marilyn Antrim of Arapahoe District Court on cross motions for summary judgment. We, on behalf of Starr, moved for partial summary judgment, claiming that under Washington law, either by incorporation to the contract or independently, that Quiznos, QFA, had violated the law, and as a result of not giving us a 1 year's notice of non-renewal, relieving us from the non-compete as required by Washington law and other grounds, we deserved our goodwill. And we deserved as damages, attorney's fees, or whatever else was allowed. QFA, on the other hand, moved for total summary judgment. It was granted, and we're here today. So the first issue I'd like to discuss is that, in our view, the parties incorporated Washington law, in particular the Washington State Franchise Investment Act, into their contract. We didn't think of the Washington Rider. We, Starr, did not write the Washington Rider. It's Exhibit A to the record, and what it provides in particular to the 1999 agreement, that these statutes, or these states, may have statutes which may supersede the area director marketing agreement and your relationship with us, citing Washington law. In the event of a conflict of law, the provisions of the Washington Franchise Investment Protection Act shall prevail. Now, what we have in the Washington Rider is an incorporation by reference, which Colorado law allows. If parties wish, they can incorporate most anything as a guide or as a principle. Now, this isn't the first time that Quiznos, as part of the central part of the relationship, used the word franchise or ascribed the franchise concept, which we believe fits squarely, but obviously is an argument. For instance, the FTC requires an offering circular before you can get a franchise into the system. So they came up, as part of the record, with a 1999 area director franchisee offering circular saying, we offer restaurants as franchises, and we're offering you a franchise to sell and supervise and open and do everything else under our system. Not just at your whim, but the Quiznos system, which, as you know, there's three cardinal points to a franchise, and that is an agreement, oral or written, no argument. Pay them some money, $165,000, no argument, that's what Starr paid. And three, it's got to be a system that's prescribed by the franchisor or by the grantor, if we don't want to start using that word, that you have to follow, because you're in league with them, and they control you in many ways. So then there's the Rights Act. So now we move to the Securities and Exchange Commission. They were a public company at that time, their predecessor, and they filed a Form 10KB, KSB, which said, we offer restaurant franchises. Additionally, we offer franchises to area director marketing business to solicit, assist us in locating sites, and providing additional support before, during, and after the restaurant opens. So now let's turn to the agreement.
Mr. Silverman, before you turn to the agreement, you've been relying on certain facts that the parties referred to the term franchise and franchisee. Is that dispositive of the issue, or what is the court to do with that on summary judgment?
Well, it's certainly an admission, and you can't, in my view, you can't totally read it away and say, oh, they just kind of use those words abstractly because it's in the agreement, etc. But no, I don't rely on that, because if I were forced, in the second argument, to say that Washington law is independent of the contract and that I have to prove it, that it does apply to the parties, then the only part of Washington law we disagree with is that sentence that says something to the effect of, you've got to a granting of the right to engage in the business of offering or selling goods or services. So you asked about facts. We then look at Quiznos, QFA focuses on, oh, you must be a broker. because you're selling. Well, that's one facet, and we pointed out Washington law says you can be many categories under that act. But our primary job after getting somebody, where we get 50% of the fee of the commission, is to help them find the place, help them build out the place, open the place, the restaurant, give them advice under the Quiznos system, and we get 40% of the royalty fees. That's not an incidental amount, because royalty fees are 6 to 7% of gross sales. So I'm not relying on that alone, but I think it's pretty powerful.
Mr. Silverman, is it a problem for you that instead of basically negotiating directly for these services, they're basically provided through Quiznos or QFA?
When I put out a menu as a restaurant franchisee, I'm using their format, maybe their printing. I mean, that's the idea of a franchise, is you operate not through the franchisor, but using their program.
But they're selling the sandwiches directly.
Well, that isn't the only requirement. There's so many diverse types of franchises. I mean, I know this might sound a little colloquial, but isn't this a franchise to sell or to operate or to superintend franchises? I mean, franchises are diverse. I mean, we don't just have grease monkeys. You don't have to have a building. That's why I was getting back to Washington law, if we, you know, want to focus on it, because what it says is, besides please have an agreement, please pay some money, a granting of the right to engage in the business, we're in business, we're trying to make money, of offering or selling goods or services. Now, the restaurant sells goods. Maybe it sells services. Thank you for coming to our restaurant. Please have a seat. But we know they're eating sandwiches and chips. Here, our services are find the franchise, build out the store, open the store, quality control. That's a service for the public, let alone Quiznos for its reputation. Provide assistance or advice.
So, all of that performed under a marketing plan prescribed or suggested in substantial part by QFA?
Yes.
And how did they have some sort of a marketing plan as to how you or how Star would obtain these new franchisees and how you would make that sale and how you would bring them into the fold?
The area director manual. And if you read the agreement, it says you have to have a telephone, you have to have a fax machine, you can get your materials from us, you may have to pay for them. I mean, the agreement within its four corners says follow our plan or your duck soup. But the manual prescribes, here's the kind of ad to put in the paper, here's the way you answer, here's some questions that they might ask you, here's how you answer them, here's the form for the quality inspection, please turn it in or you lose your royalties. All that is in the record.
Mr. Silverman, you indicated when you first stood up here that Washington law applies either by incorporation or independently. So can you explain independently?
Yes. That's where your questions have kind of gotten me there, which is, okay, do we fit within the definition of franchisee? We have cited to you two Washington cases where Nick and Willie's, because that came out of Colorado, so I kind of think that is a favorite. It's called Something Sweet LLC versus Nick and Willie's, a 2010 Washington Court of Appeals case, and Nelson versus National Funding Raising, a 1992, I think it's a Supreme Court of Washington case. Both those were area directors, that's the name, who found franchisees and superintended the restaurants, you know, opened them and helped them out. They were found to be franchisees. So that's where I can go through the big litany, which we hopefully did in the brief, of saying, here are the services. I think the hang up sometimes is, I'm thinking of a franchise as selling widgets or selling food or gas. But, and again, Molly Maids, they sell services. There are just a diverse type of variety, and that's why they don't drill down in most of these statutes to something that specific.
Mr. Silverman, let me take a step back. First of all, you are presupposing that Washington law applies.
Well, just and in I guess, this argument, yes.
Right. And so why does Washington law apply?
Because we offer services under their prescribed plan. And we paid money and we signed an agreement. That I'm just going off the definition of franchise. It's in the beginning of the statute. And a precedent that says doing these types of things means you're a friend. And the Washington Rider, which sort of, even if you don't incorporate it, even though it's Exhibit A, says beware. Washington law is out there. So we are aware. Now, why didn't they follow it? Because my time is drawing nigh, so I want to go through that. Washington law says if you're a franchisee, give them 1 year's notice of non-renewal. Relieve them of a covenant not to compete. If not, you owe them goodwill and some other things. Number two, under the investment or franchise bill of rights, franchisee bill of rights, it says don't act in good faith or do act in good faith. Explicit. Offering a 3-year buyout at their discretion, their price, that they could exercise the first day is not a 10-year renewal. Now, we'll hear argument, and I guess I'll spend more time on it, that it says terms may be materially different. Does that mean you can have a grease monkey franchise, that they could change the whole concept? No. It's subsidiary terms that can be changed. We're, of course, arguing that we deserve, even if Washington law goes down, to argue the case on good faith under Colorado law, breach of contract, that we had 63 separate or 68 separate facts. And then there's the Alawalia one that I learned how to pronounce after many years, where we, again, feel we've made out that case. But it's a subsidiary. That's, you know, we'd love to win all or part. But what I'd now like to spend just a minute or two, because I see 3 minutes, Your Honor, is this. What do you do? First of all, as you know, as our first argument, but I had it as my last, the judge said she found that the facts as set forth by QFA are to be persuasive. Now, you can try to talk it away, use a Western District of Louisiana case that did have its independent grounds, but as we've said, as you've said, we will scrutinize the trial court's findings critically under these circumstances. So here's our view of relief. No matter what the court found on the facts, which we think were flawed due to the credibility determinations, as a matter of law, we ask for a finding that Washington law was incorporated, that you relieve us of the summary judgment, you direct the trial court to enter partial summary judgment on the Washington law issue, or in the alternative, that it be reversed so that it can be tried on those subjective issues of good faith and fair dealing, whether under Washington law or Colorado law, and we think we have made out the case that there should be a trial on this matter. Thank you.
Please the court. Good morning. My name is Michael Sink, registration number 36064. With me today is Lynn McPhee. Starr has spent a considerable amount of time, both in his briefing before this court and again today, on two non-essential points. The first is that the terms of the renewal contract effectively denied it a 10-year renewal by including a buyback provision. And second, that Starr is a franchisee under the Washington Franchise Investment Protection Act. Starr is wrong on both points, and the district court correctly rejected those arguments, and QFA has briefed them extensively. I'm happy to answer any questions you have about them. But it is not necessary to resolve either issue to affirm the district court's ruling on summary judgment. 5 undisputed facts lie at the center of this case. First is that after Starr sent QFA a notice of intent to renew, QFA informed Starr that it agreed to renew the area director agreement, provided that Starr complied with conditions set forth in Section 16 of the Area Director Marketing Agreement. Second, that after negotiations between the parties, QFA offered a final development quota of 37 total stores to be open by the end of the renewal term, which would have required STAR to open an additional 15 stores over that 10-year period. Third, QFA's final offer did not trigger STAR's contractual right to arbitrate the reasonableness of the development quota. Four, STAR did not agree to QFA's final development offer. And five, STAR's contract expired on May 25th, 2009 without renewal. From these conclusions, from these undisputed facts, follow three conclusions. The first is that QFA did not breach the Area Director Marketing Agreement. It expired by its own terms because STAR did not meet a condition precedent to renewal, namely agreeing to a new development quota that fell under the arbitration threshold. Second, QFA did not violate the Washington Franchise Investment Protection Act because, even if it was a franchisee, the Protection Act does not protect the expiration of a Area Director Marketing Agreement where the franchisee refuses to accept the renewal terms. And three, QFA did not violate the Washington Consumer Protection Act because in the absence of a Franchise Investment Protection Act claim, there's no predicate act for the Consumer Protection Act claim. First then, QFA did not breach the Area Director Marketing Agreement because STAR failed to meet a condition for renewal. Section 16.2 of the Area Director Marketing Agreement, in clear and unambiguous terms, provided that at the end of the primary term, AD shall have the option to renew its area director rights for an additional 10 years so long as it met a series of conditions. The first condition, subsection A, allowed for renewal so long as STAR, at least 60 days prior to the expiration of the term, executes the form of area director marketing agreement then in use by the franchisor, which agreement may contain materially different terms than those in this agreement, provided that the area director shall not be required to pay a new initial fee, and commission percentages and the definition of the territory will not be altered.
What does materially different terms actually mean in this context?
Well, in this context, it means some term that affects either price, quantity, or time, potentially. STAR has attempted to argue that by including the buyback, that there is a provision that's altering the time for the renewal, and therefore it's a materially different term. Even if STAR's right about that, however, 16.2A clearly allows that change. The parties negotiated a limit on that ability for QFA by providing that QFA could not charge a new initial fee, alter the commission percentages, or the definition of the territory. Having negotiated the limits of that discretion under that provision, QFA was entitled to provide a new franchise offering or a new franchise, a new area director marketing agreement with a buyback provision in it.
Is there a buyback provision in the original marketing agreement?
There was not. As Mr. Silverman points out, QFA registered its area director marketing agreements with the FTC annually, and so the area director marketing agreement that was provided to STAR was the version then currently registered with the FTC, and it was the version that would have been signed by any area director that was agreeing to become a Quiznos area director at the time.
Mr. Singh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, so adding a buyback agreement to the new ADMA, is it ADMA?
That's correct.
was materially different.
STAR contends it was. We don't necessarily agree with that. Our argument is that even if it was, the contract allowed it to be included.
And the contract would allow a different term such as that, even though it would result in the contract potentially being terminated the day it was written. And that materially different language, according to your argument, allows that to occur.
That is correct, although I would add two important caveats. The first is that the contract had a termination provision in it, even the original version, that would have allowed QFA to terminate the contract for non-performance. So if STAR had failed to meet its obligations under the contract, it would have been terminated potentially day one had it not met it. So there had always been within the contract some mechanism by which to terminate the area director marketing agreement earlier than the 10 years, which is somewhat problematic about STAR's argument, because if you accept it, you would have to read out any ability for QFA to terminate the contract prior to 10 years. STAR wants to read the 10-year term provision as an absolute that trumps every other provision in the contract. And we would argue that not only the termination provisions, for example, but also the buyback provision is an appropriate exception to that term. The second piece I would point out is that the buyback provision would have afforded STAR compensation. It's not as if the buyback provision just allowed QFA to buy back the territory for some nominal amount. There was a formula specified in the contract that would have given STAR valuable consideration for the purchase of its area director rights. And I would go further to add that there was no evidence in the record below that that QFA had an intent to buy back the contract on day one. That has just been a supposition that QFA had the ability to, but there's no evidence that QFA intended to do so.
Question would be to you, and I would also ask Mr. Silverman this: Why would QFA do that? why would QFA go through the process of renegotiating the management agreement just to buy it back on the first day? I don't see that as being reasonable,
Your Honor. There were a series of negotiation points in Section 16 that QFA could have stuck on if it had wanted just to deny STAR the renewal term. It didn't want to do that, as evidenced by its letter indicating that it intended to renew. Here it was in the business interest of QFA to renew STAR's area director agreement, provided that it met with Section 16, provided that it agreed to a new development quota for the 10-year term, and STAR was unwilling to do so. And I guess that's probably the higher level argument, which is that even if, for the sake of argument, STAR had some valid concerns about the inclusion of a buyback in the renewal document, the parties never got to the point of executing the renewal document because STAR never agreed to the new area director development quota, which had to occur under the contract 30 days prior to the parties executing the new renewal agreement. And because STAR never agreed to the development quota, the parties never could have entered into the renewal contract with or without the buyback. The development quota was an essential term of the renewal contract. In fact, the buyback provision is triggered in part under STAR's argument based on the development quota that would have been in place had the parties agreed to it in the first place. So we're at a level of hypothetical possibilities that have gone beyond what actually the course of negotiations between the parties led to, which is that QFA offered a final development quota that was reasonable under the terms of the contract. STAR was unwilling to accept them, and as a result, did not renew the contract. Under Washington law, both under the Franchise Investment Protection Act and the WCPA, the Washington Consumer Protection Act, that form of non-renewal is not actionable. Under the Washington Franchise Investment Protection Act, in the two cases we cited to you, Corp versus Atlantic Richfield by the Washington Supreme Court, and then again a district court decision out of the U.S. District Court in Washington called Thompson v. Arco, both courts held that where a franchisor, assuming that you're under the act, a franchisor offers renewal to a franchisee on the terms then offered under its current franchise agreement, and the franchisee walks away, that is not non-renewal for purposes of the act. That controlling authority has been unrebutted throughout the course of this case, and I think clearly resolves the Franchise Investment Protection Act claim, regardless of whether or not you find STAR to be a franchisee under the statute. Clearly, we contend that STAR isn't a franchisee for various reasons. First is that it had registered as a broker with the state of Washington. That registration is controlling as to what status it took under the statute. If you read the definitions of the statute, the definition of a franchisee and a broker are mutually exclusive. The case cited by STAR, the Nick and Willie's case, involved an area director who is also, separate and apart from being an area director, a franchisee, and in that capacity held two hats. But it did not occupy both positions simultaneously. And even in the Nick and Willie's case, that sort of conclusion is included only in the background facts of the case. The case contains no discussion of the interpretation of the definitions of the statute, and there is no holding by the court there that the area director was simultaneously, while operating as an area director, also a franchisee.
The simultaneous status as a broker and a franchisee be based on different activities? For example, the broker aspect of it in the recruitment, per se, of the companies, and then the offering and selling of services could qualify under the franchise.
Potentially, that's correct, Your Honor. Star here, however, does not occupy both positions simultaneously. And there's some confusion, or at least some uncertainty, in some of Mr. Silverman's statements about who Star is supposedly offering these services to. Star is a subcontractor to QFA. The services that it provides are on behalf of QFA. Technically, it is QFA that offers things for sale or service. Star does not go out into the general public and hold itself out as an area director to provide inspections to a whole host of franchisees.
Does the statute require it be offered to a specific person?
It requires the offer of sale to franchisees, I believe, to the public, or at least that's the requirement that's been read into it by the Washington courts.
What is the meaning of under a marketing plan? Is the marketing plan, does that encompass services of consultation and support services for a restaurant?
At its core, it encompasses something along the lines that Mr. Silverman pointed out with the Grease Monkey example. So their Grease Monkey may be offering ancillary goods or products to the public, such as oil, but the real product, it's not a product, but what it's really offering is a service, which is the changing of oil. And so the statute isn't designed to include both franchisees that are either offering primarily goods and with some services on the side, or conversely, primarily services with some goods on the side. It is not, I think, meant to cover a case where you have a broker who is going out and soliciting franchises on behalf of a national franchisor for underlying franchisees. And so far as I'm aware, nothing in Nick and Willie's or other cases suggests that. I think then under the pure definition of the statutes, it doesn't meet the definition of a franchisee. As for questions about the use of language, then, in various contractual documents, disclosures, and the like, the relevant question is whether or not those statements meet the test automatically for the Washington Act. We contend that it doesn't. One still has to analyze the statutory factors. And we cited a case from Wisconsin, which has an analogous Franchise Dealership Protection Act, where court has said that the use of the word dealer in a contract doesn't automatically establish that you're a dealer for purposes of the Wisconsin Act. And we would argue that that same line of reasoning applies here.
So, Mr. Singh, does Washington law apply and why?
Our argument is no. Under the contract, the district court held otherwise. It's argued that the parties had agreed that Washington law applied. The contract specifies, however, that Colorado law applies. The parties argued below as part of the uncontested facts of the case that Colorado law applied. The district court, for whatever reason, asserted that the parties agreed that Washington law applied. We would argue that that's not the case, although if one applied, for instance, the common law of Washington, we don't think that would affect the outcome of this case.
So what is the meaning of the Washington rider?
The Washington rider was designed to notify area directors that in the event that a Washington or some other state franchise or dealership protection law applied, that the terms of that statute would control. That's why it's stated in a conditional way. It says that the state statutes may supersede this agreement, and only in the event of a conflict are these statutes to actually supersede. That is a far cry from the incorporation of otherwise inapplicable law to the party's agreement. And further along that line, the Washington rider included a whole host of other states that could potentially be applicable, and no one has made an effort to argue that all states contrary law are incorporated.
In the Washington rider, when it discusses conflict, is it talking about conflicts between the law of the states?
I believe it's talking about conflict between the terms of the agreement and the relevant statute. Thank you.
Silverman, you got a minute, 35 seconds.
About that.
For minute 45, could you address the argument that the agreement as to development quota was a condition precedent that wasn't satisfied?
I'll start. It was a requirement of the FTC that before you could negotiate, you had to have an area director franchise offering circular. In it, it had the agreement, 15.9, 3 years, buyout first day. The agreement was still born, or the it was already on the table what you had to do. So Quiznos had already frustrated the intent of the parties. It was a continuing contract. Under Colorado law, if you go that way, counsel just said, oh, materially different means price, could be price, terms, or time. That's Amoco. Amoco says once a contract's entered into by the parties and there's a weaker and stronger party, the duty of good faith and fair dealing applies when one party has discretionary authority to determine certain terms of the contract, such as quantity, price, or time. Buy you out in a day, here's the set formula. And by the way, the executive vice president testified he would never change that provision, so it was stillborn. Next question that I believe you asked, why would they have a buyout right in one day? Because as the record shows, and we didn't argue it, they were down to 17 area directors and had changed their model because they were successful. Why pay 40% anymore? So that argument is there. Next, termination for non-performance, as Mr. Sink argues, it's still in the contract. It still says we can be terminated under the renewal if we don't do a good job. That's in most every contract. This one's special. It's illusory. It says you're out of luck the first day. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your excellent arguments. They're very helpful. And this matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.